stands in the way of achieving the dream of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Why is Wisconsin, which holds the distinction of honoring Dr. King for the longest time with its official ceremony, the 34th annual tribute is scheduled for noon today at the State Capitol Rotunda, why is Wisconsin also one of the worst states when it comes to racial equality? Last month, the Center on Wisconsin Strategy released a report outlining the disparity between whites and African Americans when it comes to education, to jobs and income, to incarceration. Why is this happening and what can be done to overcome it? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Walter Farrell, professor of social work and a fellow in the Center for Urban and Regional Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And Professor Farrell also served as professor and chair of the Department of Education Policy and Community Studies at UW-Milwaukee until 1999. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks a lot for being with us.
It's always a pleasure.
Well, let me just ask you your general thoughts on this day that we honor Dr. Martin Luther King. How close are we to achieving his dream?
Well, we're stalemated right now and taking a few lurches backwards in terms of meeting the dream. And that is due to poor leadership within the African-American community, especially at the political level, and an increasing wave of conservatism in the broader community, the majority community, as we are moving through a demographic transition.
Yeah, talk about some of the things, the steps backwards that have occurred.
Well, there has been no coherent national leadership within the African American community, even at the various state levels since Dr. King's assassination, you know, because he was, although it was somewhat balkanized at that time, because the sheer force of his personality and his charisma and his intellect, he was able to keep it, at least publicly, together.
Mm-hmm.
And although there were ongoing tensions between him and the heads of the Urban League, and the NAACP and CORE and SNCC, because the young people who didn't think he was moving fast enough, the older heads such as Roy Wilkins and Whitney Young and James Farmer, they thought that he was getting too much credit because he was much younger than they were, and all of a sudden he had risen to national and international prominence. And they resented that on a personal level of jealousy. But and then they thought that their policies were the most effective ones for bringing African Americans to the mainstream. The NAACP felt that you could litigate the African American community toward equality. The Urban League felt that by aligning themselves with corporations, you could provide more and better jobs. And CORE thought that you could organize the community. And SNCC, comprised of young people, they wanted it black power, and they wanted it now. And so you had all of those competing interests, and Dr. King held steadfastly to his principles of nonviolence. Because although he was a very young man, he had studied and reflected and observed this as a graduate student at the Crozier Theological Seminary when he was working on his bachelor's and master's in divinity, and at Boston University while he was pursuing his PhD. So as a very young man in his early 20s, he was quite conversant with what Gandhi had done, with what Nelson Mandela was trying to do. So he brought a much broader international perspective even before we knew who he was. And so those competing interests in the African American community at national, state, and local levels have metastasized since his passing.
Yeah. Well, we wanted to talk a little bit about this report that was released last month from the Center on Wisconsin Strategy. This report was on the state of Wisconsin and racial equality, and it's not very good at all. It says we're worst for the proportion of African Americans participating in the labor force, and the third worst for the overall unemployment rate. The disparity between eighth graders on math is also the worst in the nation, and we're the second worst for incarcerating African Americans. There's a lot to talk about here, but give us your thoughts on this. I mean, you used to live and teach here in Wisconsin. Why do you think Wisconsin in particular is so bad in all of these areas of racial equality?
Well, these data are not new. They're just updated. You know, when I was at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee from 78 to 99, I had to track these kinds of data on a regular basis. You know, and so nothing has gotten worse, except it has maybe perhaps gotten a little better in terms of rates of incarceration. When I left Wisconsin in 1999, the state of Wisconsin was first in rates of African-American male incarceration. Now it's second. So you could say that there's been improvement. But all of those findings were the same in 1999. They were the same in 1990. And they were the same in 1980 because I was looking through my files in preparation for our discussion today over the weekend. Nothing has changed. And part of that has been due to the manufacturing of the state when jobs have been moved overseas consistently over time.
Yeah.
And part of it has to do with, you know, sad to say, in Milwaukee, where most of those statistics have a serious impact because you have the largest concentration of African Americans in the state in Milwaukee County. It has to do with political leadership. You know, when you have the president of the Milwaukee Common Council encouraging the expansion of corporate-owned charter schools, supporting vouchers, as is Dr. Fuller, who approves vouchers in Milwaukee in a program the state granted him power to do that. When you have that occurring over a period of time, which I feel based on the data that I've got, is in the disinterest of the African-American communities. So you have African-American leaders aiding and abetting the demise of the community.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about why you are opposed to the voucher school program in Milwaukee, which, of course, is also now being expanded in Wisconsin.
Oh, sure, because they don't work. All of the data that consistently comes out by the State Department of Education, by those researchers, most notably at the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville, and other researchers who received their funding from right-wing corporations and foundations to do consistent studies of vouchers, show they don't work. And if they do work, is by minuscule amounts. And that despite the fact that in voucher and charter schools, you can dismiss students at will. And so most charter schools don't reflect the population distribution of students in a service area. And then there is limited accountability. Just last week, the Life Skills Voucher School closed in Milwaukee in the middle of the night and sent the Department of Education a letter saying we're closed, you know, before they contacted the parents. Over the last 5 years, they've drawn more than $2 million in funding to supposedly educate academically challenged students. During that period, they had one student, one, mind you, and they had initially had an enrollment over 200. One passed all of the exams given to show that a person is performing at an effective level. One student. And there's nothing in state law that allows the money to be recaptured. So these individuals took the money, used it for whatever. They certainly didn't educate any students. And now they're gone. They're not subject to any criminal charges. This is an educational version of the subprime loan scandal on Wall Street. Yeah. How many people have gone to jail for issuing subprime loans? Not many, not any that I've heard of. But millions of people, homes were foreclosed on, or their mortgages are underwater. So, and nobody on Wall Street who perpetrated this heinous economic act is held accountable.
Do you
the same occurs for vouchers and charter schools.
Is it your contention, Dr. Farrell, that if we did not have the voucher program or what's called the parental choice program, that the educational achievement gap between African Americans and whites would not be as wide as it is today?
No, I'm not contending because we don't know, because we have it. We've had it for 22 years in Wisconsin, and over those 22 years, the gap hasn't closed. So we know that vouchers and charters are not the answer, and they've consistently expanded. So I can't say, I think that what I can contend that if we had tried something else, like investing in public education, investing in teachers, there might be a better outcome. But I don't know, because we didn't. And so despite the championing of these initiatives by the business community, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, other newspapers across the state, they haven't worked. All of the available data from the people who support it and the people who conducted objective research, some of which I've conducted myself, show they don't work. And when they do, when they are alleged to work, the data are manipulated. I published an article with my colleague Alex Molnar and others 20 years ago in a major educational journal where we dissected one of the studies that claimed that vouchers were working. And we showed that they had manipulated statistical analyses. And when that was presented and they responded to our critique, they said, well, this is just a pilot study. But nobody reads the Phi Delta Kappa, so that goes unheralded. And plus, we don't have the money like the people on. We didn't have the money like the people on the right to get our message out in the major print media organs, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, or the major networks. And these individuals have those connections. So whether you watch Fox News, CNN or MSNBC, all that are allegedly on different ends of the ideological spectrum, they all agree on one thing. Charters and vouchers and school choice is the best thing, especially for low-income, academically challenged students of color. This is a way to make money, and when you have a public education budget that nationally is two-thirds of $1 trillion, on an annual basis, if you get any chunk of that money, you can make a lot of people rich. And they've exhausted privatizing the prison system, and now education is the next public sector budget to be profitized and privatized.
We are talking with Walter Farrell, a professor of social work and a fellow in the Center for Urban and Regional Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He was also a professor and chair of the Department of Education Policy and Community Studies at UW-Milwaukee. And we're talking with him on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day on the status of racial equality in Wisconsin and the nation. And we'll also talk about the future of civil rights in Wisconsin and the nation. And we welcome your questions and your views. How can Dr. King's dream be accomplished? 1-800-642-1234. Why do you think we are seeing such huge gaps in literacy, education, and incarceration in Wisconsin? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about Martin Luther King's dream. At noon today, we will celebrate the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in words and music. It's Wisconsin's 34th annual tribute and ceremony at the State Capitol Rotunda in Madison. The celebration this year is themed, "We Shall Not Be Moved." And that's coming up today at noon, live from the State Capitol, hosted by Wisconsin Public Radio's Jonathan Overby. We are talking about the civil rights movement and where we are now on this Martin Luther King Day, what progress has been made for African Americans since assassination of Dr. King, what threatens the achievements of the civil rights movement today. We are talking with a guest who is discouraged at the future of civil rights progress, both in Wisconsin and in the nation. And we are talking about the poor state of affairs when it comes to racial equality in Wisconsin. And we're welcoming your thoughts and questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We are talking with Walter Farrell, a professor of social work and a fellow in the Center for Urban and Regional Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, formerly with UW-Milwaukee. And Guy from Menasha emails, "So, your guest is saying that there were no issues with academics, employment, and incarceration before the voucher program? What?" Many question marks. And he says, "What about the low graduation rates of African American students in Milwaukee public schools? Has that not increased since the voucher program?" Dr. Farrell?
Raises a very good point. Oh, these problems existed before the voucher program, no question about it. But they have not improved since the voucher program mm-hmm. in terms of education. And the voucher program supposedly was designed to facilitate that. And so did the problems exist prior to that? Absolutely. And I don't lay all of the blame on teachers and administrators in the public schools, because I was there during the administration of Lee McMurrin, and there was a lot of opposition to him from the African American community, especially with respect toward the way he implemented court ordered school desegregation. But the schools overall were functioning better then than they are now, because when you introduced vouchers that were unaccountable, charter schools that were unaccountable, largely, it didn't improve the matter. So let's give one example. From 1990, when the first voucher school opened in the fall of 1990, until 2005, there were no credential requirements for an individual to teach in the Milwaukee public schools. None. You didn't have to have a bachelor's degree. You didn't have to have a high school diploma. The legislation was silent on that. It only emerged in 2005 when the first Latino state legislator, now Judge Pedro Colon, was on the Joint Finance Committee, and when they did their routine vote for the reauthorization of funding for the voucher program, he looked, being a lawyer, he looked at the legislation. He said, there's no credential requirements in here. So he authored a motion, and this is 2005. The program has already been in operation 15 years. They say that for henceforth and evermore, when all teachers to have at least a bachelor's degree. Not that they had to have certification, but at least to have a bachelor's degree. The committee was thrown into turmoil, and they called for a recess. Now, Senator Alberta Darling, and I have the documents in my position, opposed that because she said that then many of the parents would not be able to teach in the voucher schools because they didn't have that. The question becomes, why should someone be able to teach academically challenged children without any credentials? So the compromise was, and this was 2005, Representative Colon couldn't get his motion through. Nobody would second it on the Joint Finance Committee. So the compromise was that from 2005 forward, all teachers in voucher schools would have to have at least a high school diploma. But if you didn't have it, you could be grandfathered in.
You know, Dr. Farrell, we have in Madison, where we have not had a parental choice program, we also have these disparities in the educational achievement gap between whites and African Americans. And in fact, a report came out recently about Dane County, which is the county where Madison is the seat, saying, you know, what's the matter with Madison, progressive Madison? This kind of awful disparity exists here, too. What else is contributing to this?
Well, the major contribution is access to jobs, that individuals don't have jobs. And if you look, see, you have to link all of these different components together. Because what was pointed out in the report was that Wisconsin has the lowest rates of African American labor force participation in the country. Mm-hmm. And so whatever about what is occurring in Madison, the African American community has extraordinarily high rates of unemployment, more than double of what is occurring in the white community. Same in Milwaukee. On top of that, you've had the destabilization of African American families, where more than 60% of the young people, of children born in Dane County and Milwaukee County, are born to single parent households, and mostly young people. And so you have the decline of jobs, the stabilization of family, and when those students start to move through the educational system, that's reflected in the schoolhouse, those external factors. And so no matter how many people try to say, well, we can, all we need, as the Gates Foundation said, is a qualified teacher in front of every classroom. Well, if the students are sitting in front of that teacher are poor, hungry, come from violent, having to traverse violent environments as they've had to on the way to school in Milwaukee and other cities, have to worry about getting shot at a bus stop as occurred 2 years ago to a young woman who was shot and killed after she got off the bus. Well, that has an impact on the focus on education in the schoolhouse. So you have to look at the level of unemployment now, the level of dysfunctionality in families, the level of violence in the economically distressed communities in a city such as Madison and broader Dade County, Milwaukee, and all of that combusts to contribute to lower performance in schools. It doesn't just start in the schoolhouse as to what the quality of education is going to be.
Let me go to Mike in Preston, Minnesota. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
Good morning, Mike.
Yes. Good morning. And I just wanted to make a comment on the topic that you were talking about. And I don't know all the ins and outs of the vouchers and bolstering public this public school system, but I'm a Mexican-American, and I know in our community especially where we have families that are destabilized, whether they're single parents or parents who have problems, you know, whether alcohol or drugs or things like that, that always has a, you know, the direct correlation on how kids, how well kids do and how well they develop. And I think, you know, one of the biggest issues in our country is that destabilization of families these days. I mean, you know, even within my family and my community, you know, there's so many divorces, and that just causes, I think it raises havoc on kids. Yeah. Because I see kids and they look, you know, to their parents to be stable and to be the examples. And I think just all of us in America, regardless of race or background, I think we'd be better served in the future if we all come together to try to bolster, you know, that family and try to, you know, work together to have programs that help families stay together and work through problems and things of that nature.
Thank you very much, Mike.
I couldn't have said it better than Mike. Mm-hmm. And nobody ever says that, because the arguments that you hear trumpeted on the front pages of the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, is that these teachers are horrible, and we got to hold them accountable. We got to evaluate them using standardized tests. We can only give them raises if the standardized tests show that they've been effective teachers. And not any of this, the points that Mike raised, are discussed. And it's silly. It's absolutely silly for people to trumpet that foolishness and then policymakers accept it with whole cloth. In North Carolina, where we have a worse situation than even in Wisconsin, the last spring they enacted two voucher programs, one for special needs children, one for regular education children. They lifted the cap on charter schools. They have legislation that charter school teachers don't have to have the same credentials as traditional public school teachers. Then they froze teachers' salary. They laid off 3,800 aides across the state. They cut $500 million out of the public education budget. And now they're going to evaluate teachers using standardized tests. And their evaluation will be based on 80% of their evaluation will be based on the outcomes of those standardized tests. And they abolished tenure for teachers, and now teachers can only be given 1 to 4 year contracts, and they are convinced in this Republican-controlled legislature, like Wisconsin, that somehow this is going to redound to the educational benefit of students. And they are doing this all across the country.
I think that Stephen Fremont has a similar comment. Hi, Steve.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
I've been listening to you, Professor, and I agree with about 95% of what you're saying, which is actually for me a compliment. I personally feel it is actually the breakdown of the African-American family. The reason why I say that is I go back to the time of Martin Luther King and such. When he was around, it was a very strong African-American family network. You definitely had a father, you had a mother, you had children, and they were raised up in a very firm household. But that has broken down basically since we put in some of the poverty acts where the girls, when they become pregnant, do not have to name the fathers. So now the fathers are no longer responsible. So now there is no longer a father figure. And a woman is trying to raise the kids on their own, and it's just overwhelming. And the kids then no longer learn responsibility, and responsibility and respect carries over into school. So now we no longer have them learning in school. And if you do not have an education, I don't care how much money you throw at them, if you don't want the ability to learn or have an education, you cannot help yourself. And that's actually starting to show up in other parts of our society, our white society or whatever you want to call it. It's a very bad thing that the family breaks down.
Yeah, Steve, thanks very much. I wanted to ask you specifically, Professor Farrell, Steve's theory that the African-American family broke down in part because of policies enacted on the war on poverty.
I agree with 95% of what Steve says, but I disagree on the link between the war on poverty. Mm-hmm. Because actually, if we look at all of the data, the level of poverty has declined since the late President Lyndon Baines Johnson declared war on it in 1965. I testified at the 25th anniversary year of the war on poverty in 1990 before the Joint Economic Committee of the United States Congress. And I made the points I'm making here. The war on poverty didn't fail. What was happening, that they stopped funding it. And you could track the percentage of the American population and the African-American population in poverty in 1965 and 2014, and there is a significant decline. But part of Bill Clinton saying that we change welfare as we know it. Mm-hmm. Were there some issues of the welfare programs that weren't properly run? Most likely. But the major issue, and Steve keynoted it, was the breakdown on the family. Now, the family didn't break down because of the poverty program. The family broke down because of lack of access to family-supporting work. And many of the young men who were impregnating young ladies, they never married, and that was in part because the woman had access to a welfare program. But more importantly, the young male didn't have access to work. And that was a key thing. And I look at it from my own experience. My mother was pregnant with me when she was 18 years old, mm-hmm. in a senior year in high school. And she was able to camouflage it and graduate. When she became impregnated by my father, they didn't get married right away. But they got married shortly after. And my father had dropped out of high school, but he was industrious, hardworking. And so when I came into this world, I had a father and a mother who were married, and my father had a job. In fact, he had several jobs. He was able to support me and my mother while she stayed home to take care of me. And he went on to have four more children. And my mother never really worked a full-time job, but he had enough work, being an eighth grade dropout, where he could support his family in a middle class style of life. That can't happen today.
Well, we are talking with Walter Farrell, a professor of social work and a fellow in the Center for Urban and Regional Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He was previously a professor and chair of the Department of Education Policy and Community Studies at UW-Milwaukee until 1999. And we are talking with him on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day about the state of racial equality in the nation and here in Wisconsin. Last month, the Center on Wisconsin Strategy released a report that outlined the disparity between whites and African Americans when it comes to education, to jobs and income, to incarceration. And we here in Wisconsin, among the worst states in the nation. Talking about why this is happening and what can be done to overcome it. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about what is standing in the way of achieving the dream of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. on this holiday when we pay tribute to him. Talking with Walter Farrell, who is a professor of social work and a fellow in the Center for Urban and Regional Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Let's go back to the phones. Alice in Madison is with us. Hello, Alice. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm an educated Black American female. I see among my friends who have advanced degrees similar problems with racism in Dane County. I would like you to restate those statistics. I believe that disparity exists because whites want to keep what they have. And in this economy where people have less, they like to keep what they have and they will not share with other people. The fact that African Americans don't have the same opportunities in the state of Wisconsin, because we're one of the lowest states regarding business creation. As long as we can employ our own people and create jobs for us, we're still going to lag behind. If you look at education, no matter what level of education they complete, there's still a disparity in income. I find that this whole aspect of single family is a problem, but racism is a bigger problem in this state. I have done everything. I have advanced degree from the University of Wisconsin, Madison, yet I face barriers when it comes to employment, an income gap in my job. And I hear the same thing from my friends who are lawyers, who are nurses, who are administrators. They tell me the same problems that I'm facing they have. Could you please elaborate on issues of lack of mentoring, lack of breaking the glass ceiling in employment? Those are important factors, particularly for us educated blacks who have done everything to try to advance ourselves.
Thank you very much, Alice, for calling. And yes, what about there's racism here, Walter Farrell.
Absolutely. Racism would not be eradicated during my lifetime for a number of reasons. And I think it would persist on two or three lifetimes. Now, to be fair, it is not nearly as virulent as it used to be. So there has been progress. At the same time, Alice makes a good point. We just take college-educated blacks at every level, of advanced degree. There's the unemployment rate for them is twice that of their white counterparts. Those are facts that have persisted, as has the unemployment rate for African Americans overall. Now, part of it is because majority citizens are somewhat fearful of losing their place in society, and especially in terms of a tight economy. And we see these situations that are fueled by the change of demographics, because we know, because a majority of whites of all ethnic persuasions as a group are having fewer children. And all of the other ethnic minority groups, Asians, African Americans, Latinos, American Indians, and the like have higher birth rates. So when you project that into the future, the majority community can see themselves losing, you know, and they don't want to give up their position in society or in the workplace. And it's not occasioned by the virulent racial animus of a generation ago. It's saying, I want to keep my place. And so as they perceive African-American, other groups of color, increasing their numbers, they've implemented a number of strategies. Voter ID in Wisconsin and 35 other states. Some of it has been overturned. Much of it has not. Because they say with these numbers growing, along with the increase of progressive whites, that our position will be overrun. And so they say we can't keep their numbers from increasing. What we can do is make it harder for them to vote. And we have some of the most stringent laws in that regard in North Carolina of any of the 36 states that currently have it on the books or trying to place it on the books. And that was caused by the fact that President Obama won this state in 2008, the first time a Democrat had won it in 32 years, and almost won it again in 2012, lost by 2 percentage points when the governor, Republican governor, was winning it by 12. And so people become concerned about that. And in the workplace, be it corporate, nonprofit, they see African-Americans and other people of color taking their jobs because what we have, and nobody says this out loud, is a subtle rising of apartheid in the workplace, in the political sphere, and the like. As people, and this has occurred historically when one population sees their numbers decline as other populations grow. And in the summer of 1919, there were race riots all across the country because there had been large in migrations of African Americans from the South into Chicago, New York, St. Louis, Springfield, Missouri, the birthplace of Abraham Lincoln, and all of that, because people all of a sudden saw all of these non-new residents. Although African Americans had lived in those places, they hadn't lived in large numbers. And now we see the same attitude, the anti-immigration policies that are being pushed forward by conservative congressmen, because they say, well, if these Hispanics come in here, first of all, they're not going to vote Republican, so we don't want to have the immigration policies that we had of earlier years. So there are some truth to all of that, but many individuals are unwilling to take a hard look at it.
Let me bring in a caller on this topic that you just concluded with there, Cliff in Appleton. Hi, Cliff.
Hi. I wanted to ask the professor if he believed the election of President Obama gave many people in society, the Tea Party folks, the motivation to do some of the things that they're doing. I'm also a graduate of UNC Chapel Hill. I've been in Wisconsin since 1997, and I think that the racism is more sophisticated now. And Wisconsin's home to the John Birch Society, and the Tea Party is very sophisticated. The racism isn't as violent, but the methods they're using are more insidious. And I wanted his opinion about the election of President Obama giving motivation to a lot of people to hurt us more.
Did that? Do you think that played a role, Walter?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about it. Many conservatives, especially on the Tea Party side, it was, and let me draw on that, it was like a dormant cancer. You know, you go to the doctor, and the doctor say, well, you have pancreatic cancer. And he said, but it had lain dormant for several years, and it just is emerging now. When President Obama was elected, men of the Tea Party said, well, the African Americans got their candidate. We got to do something. African Americans didn't elect President Obama. That was a multiracial coalition of whites who gave him the largest number of the votes in his first election and his second. African-Americans, Native Americans, Hispanics, and Asians. He had a multiracial coalition. But many on the Tea Party side saw black people did that. And they began to erect and advocate policies and legislation to what they consider undo that. And they were convinced that they were going to do it in 2012. And so they selected a candidate that they thought that could do that. And they finally settled on Mitt Romney because they had concluded that although President Obama had won in 2008, that was a fluke because he had so much money, 3-4 times the money as John McCain. Well, in 2012, Mitt Romney actually had more direct and indirect contributions to his campaign than President Obama. But what happened, they misread it. The majority of the citizens of every race and ethnicity in this country have become more accepting of a diverse nation. But you have this minority Tea Party who wants to return to an earlier point in time, and they don't want the progress that is going, and they will send their, redistricted the Congress where they can win in spite of the feelings of significant numbers, a number of members of their district, so they could put people on there who would try to pull this country to the far right. So Cliff is right on target. It's subtle. It is driven by racial animus, but it is couched. It's, well, we don't like it because of the policy. But when you strip away all of the pretentiousness, it has to do with race. But when you raise that, people say, oh, no. And then some other politicians are just riding the wave, like Governor Scott Walker, whom I know well because I knew him when he was in the legislature, because I was on leave working with the legislature when he was an assemblyman. And I followed, and we had a friendship. But he's riding the conservative wave, and he thinks that he can make it to the presidency or the presidential nomination by lining up with the Tea Party, because to their credit, they are organized.
Yeah, but Dr. Farrell, we're almost out of time. In fact, less than 30 seconds. Just if we talk with you next year on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, do you think anything's going to have changed?
Not much.
Yeah, that's kind of
unless people come together. Which they have, to elect African-American president twice, but if unless they come to together at the state and local levels, and sometimes that would mean replacing African-American and Latino politicians who are carrying the policy water for the Tea Party and other people on the right.
We'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for being with us.